Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Ending the conflict in Ukraine was never going to be easy. Donald Trump famously claimed he could end the conflict in a day. To be fair, he never said which day. Nonetheless, Trump has made his intentions clear. The problem for him is Kyiv and Europe's neoliberal ideologues back endless war. Crosstalking Trump's peace plan, I'm joined by my guest Matthew Crosston in Washington. He is a professor of national security and director of academic transformation at Bowie State University. In Virginia, we have James Jatris. He is a former U.S. diplomat and former advisor to the U.S. Senate Republican leadership. And in Plymouth, we cross to Patrick Henningsen. He is the editor and founder of the 21stCenturyWire.com. All right, let me start out with Patrick in Plymouth. Where do we stand right now? We have the Ukrainians and the Americans speaking in Jeddah in Saudi Arabia. A former Russian diplomat has said, not naming him, but he said he didn't have much high hopes, which is kind of interesting because, I mean, now they have to meet at a separate venue, not in Kyiv, not in Washington. The Trump people are keeping them at arm's length, obviously. But where are we right now? As I said in my introduction, Trump has made it very clear what he wants, and he has high expectations. So where do we see, are we at some kind of crossroads one way or the other? Patrick.
I think this is just a really incredibly difficult situation. I mean, we spoke about it, all the complications, the difficulties, how deeply enmeshed the United States and NATO and its European partners are. And I think this is an issue that's just so big. Trump has set the bar of expectations so incredibly high ahead of his inauguration, saying he could end the conflict so quickly. But the reality is it's something that transcends mere U.S. partisan politics. And so much of the Trump campaign and coming in with that wave of a mandate has been about the separation between what Biden did and that, you know, Ukraine is Biden's mess. But this really is much bigger than that. And that's one of the biggest problems. This is a quagmire of the highest order, and it's going to require a much more bold and also a much more articulate leadership. And I think it's got to be brave enough to transcend all of the usual hot take, you know, propaganda lines. I mean, we heard Marco Rubio utter multipolarism early in the game. But where is the president coming with a definitive policy speech, or the vice president saying this is the direction of the United States? And, you know, not just anti-woke hot takes at the Munich Security Conference, but something substantive, because you need to get buy-in, not just from the United States, but from the international community, where they'll look to the United States and say, actually, there will be people in factions in Europe that'll say, that makes sense. We can kind of get behind that in the interim, and while we sort out the complications and allow people to save face and get out of what is a very diabolical situation. So this is the new post Western hegemonic order that we're going into. This is Halford Mackinder's nightmare. It's upon us, Peter. It's come true. The battle for the world island is won, and it was won in Ukraine, and NATO has effectively died in Ukraine, proverbially speaking, but not yet. But we need to come to face this reality. And Trump or somebody needs to articulate this in order to move things forward.
It's so well put, because Matthew, I like how Patrick said buy-ins. You want to have people that want to get involved, and we don't have that. We don't have any carrots. We have a whole lot of sticks out there. We've seen with the pause of arms and intelligence to Ukraine. We've seen threats against Russia with more sanctions, which is kind of hollow. I mean, what else are you going to do on the front of sanctions? There really are no buy-ins here, and that is really the problem. And you also have, and I want to talk about at great length here, is the Europeans. I mean, they prefer war over peace. They've made that very clear. They've to the point where weakening Russia is far more important than achieving peace. This is where we stand, echoing what Patrick just said. Go ahead, Matthew.
No, I think that's true. And there's also the difficulty with all of this is we look at the Ukrainian side and the Russian side in terms of where will they change their positions in order to achieve any kind of dialogue. But for the Ukrainians, they'll talk about, well, the Eastern Front, we have to have our territory back. We have to end this war looking exactly the way we did when the war began. But the Russians can legitimately say, well, what kind of guarantees on security are we going to have in terms of your flirtations with Western Europe? How do we ensure that? Because honestly, if you can give us the one, I don't know if we need the eastern flank of Ukraine, quite frankly. But then what you've mentioned, Peter, is really, really important. If the Western side can change its opinion of, honestly, guys, the stalemate and the meat grinder befits us. It suits our needs long term. It's like they have to be the ones to say we want the war to end. And that's going to actually probably push the Ukrainian side a little bit further into accepting negotiations with the Russians. But until the Americans, it's really the Americans more than anything else, say, are we interested in having the war end in Ukraine? If they don't say that, then we'll be stuck in this stalemate for a while longer, I think.
Well, Jim, exactly, because the terms and conditions of the entire conversation are at stake here, is that Europe, Western Europe, they want a strategic defeat of Russia. This is what they have always wanted. Ukraine wants victory. Neither are talking about peace. That is the problem. That's why Zelensky and Europe can, at least at this point in time, not be on the same page with Trump, because Trump wants peace. He's not looking for victory. He wants peace. Jim.
I think you're right about that, Peter. And the trouble is, it seems to me, is that, you know, Marco Rubio let the cat out of the bag the other day when he said this is a proxy war between the United States and Russia. It's not just, as Trump seems to think, these two boys are fighting, as Zelensky and Putin. I'll knock some heads together and get them to talk, and I'll solve this problem, and I'm in charge. I think that's the problem we're looking at from Trump's side. He wants peace, but the more he tries to finesse this by, you know, metals deals or threatening this side or threatening that side, the more he buys in, whether he likes it or not, and makes it his war, not just Biden's war. And I think that's going to be the frustrating thing on the Russian side. Naturally, I think they would prefer some kind of a deal, but I'm beginning to think that Russia, excuse me, that America is as much non-agreement capable under Trump as it was before, and the Russians may be left with no alternative but to pursue a military solution.
Well, a military solution is going to be ultimately what's going to happen here. Patrick, you know, another thing about the whole conversation is Ukraine's security guarantees. Again, I think that's misplaced. This all is about Russia's security demands. Go back to the documents that were the Russians sent on December 15, 2021 to NATO and to the United States. It's all about security. They're very short documents. They're only about security. And when we start talking about Russian security, that's when we're going to find the solution. Patrick.
Yeah, when you hear security guarantees coming from the Ukrainian side or from like people in the U.S. or Europe advocating for Ukraine, it's completely meaningless. Security guarantees in that respect are just like a fig leaf to conceal the nakedness of the neoliberal rules-based international order. They're not worth the paper that they're written on. And they're no better than, quote, assurances, like, for instance, like a memorandum of understanding from the Ukrainian position. That's like the Budapest memorandum that everybody bandies about as, you know, there was a security guarantees. There were never security guarantees. There were just loose assurances, like a little bit of an understanding, which is null and void by this point in history. So Russia and the great powers will dictate what are the security priorities. And those will be in their interests, okay? Not the cudgel or the former cudgel in Kiev. And so this, I love this internecine warfare between, you know, the U.S., its NATO partners, and, you know, the new coalition of the willing. And this is like 2003 is calling, saying they want their strap lines back, Peter. Yeah. Tony Blair's waiting off stage as well, feeding lines to Keir Starmer.
Peter, if I can jump in real quick. There's conversations I've had for a long time now, because one of the major problems that I think we're all talking around is it just gets dismissed in the West, especially here in D.C., about Russia having security concerns, right? That's always dismissed as Russia shouldn't have security concerns about us, quote unquote. And the example I've given people without using country names, I just tell them, let me just give you a quick sort of anthropomorphic example. Let's say you live in a neighborhood in your house. You have these traditional neighbors you've had for a long time, for many years, and a new neighbor moves in, and that new neighbor proceeds to badmouth you and talk horribly about you to all of your neighbors, so that they start to not like you, they decide not to relate to you, and they basically start to make you feel isolated in your own neighborhood in which you have always lived. Then they go a step further, that new neighbor comes and knocks on your front door, says, hi, I'm the new neighbor, and you're like, what gives? Why are you doing this? I said, oh, don't worry about that. You don't have to pay attention to that. It's fine, but don't worry about what I'm saying to your neighbors. You have nothing to worry about when it comes to me. It's like, but you're really affecting the quality of life of me here in my own neighborhood, in my own house. And I ask people, well, how would you feel about that situation? Every single person here in the United States was like, oh, it would be on here between me and that new neighbor. There would definitely be words given and fists thrown. And then when I say, well, that's exactly how Russia sees what the West has done
Matthew,
for the last 10 years.
To just add flesh to that, I mean, Russia is not expanding a military alliance westward. It's NATO that's moving eastward. Again, these very, very fundamental facts are never brought up. And it's never contextualized. For 30 years, the Russians have been saying, this is a really big mistake, and at some point, we're going to have to push back. And that's exactly what happened with the special military operation. I did it on this program in real time. I kept saying, it's coming. It's finally going to come. No, the Russians, they'll back down like they always do. All right, I'm going to interrupt myself. Gentlemen, we're going to go to a hard break, and after that hard break, we'll continue our discussion on Trump's peace plan for Ukraine. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter LaBelle. To remind you, we're discussing Trump's peace plan. Okay, let's go to the great state of Virginia. Jim, during the break, you said you wanted to opine on something that's already been said on the program. Go right ahead.
Yeah, let's pick up on this question of security guarantees, because it seems to me that takes us back to those two draft treaties the Russians put out to NATO and to the United States in December of 2021, looking for binding security guarantees from the West. And the question is, what would really be binding on the West? A Security Council resolution? A treaty? As we pointed out, those are essentially just MOUs. Those are just statements of intent as far as the West is concerned. And those are pie crusts that can't really be relied on for the long term, even if Trump is totally sincere. We've been talking about a Trump peace plan, the contours of which we really don't know yet. But if there even was a real solid peace plan on paper that did not reflect changes in the reality on the ground, how much could Moscow really rely on those? And I think that's the dilemma that's being thrown out on the table here as they thrash around and try to find some way to come up with a deal, but we don't really know what that deal looks like and why anybody would be able to rely on it for the long term.
Well, Patrick, what makes it even worse, Jim's absolutely right. We really don't know if Trump has a peace plan at all. He wants the fighting to stop. We all know that, okay? What his plan is remains to be seen. But, Patrick, what's worse for Trump is that this echo chamber in Europe talking about what to do. I don't know how many conferences they've had. They have one every other day talking about how they're going to deal with this. They talk nonsense about, 800 billion euros to be invested in defense and all of this money they don't have. Money they're going to have to go into debt. Oh, the entire union is in debt. Over. I mean, it's almost child's play listening to them talk. And it's just posturing. They're just posturing. They can't imagine that they're irrelevant. They have made themselves irrelevant. They can't take it. Go ahead, Patrick.
No, there's no money. There's no money for rearming Europe. What they're proposing is really just the European Central Banks basically to pile on more unsecured debt onto EU member states. And so then the debate in Europe is, well, we need to cut back on the welfare state to build up European defenses again. So it's like austerity across the board. And there's going to be political price to pay for this in the next wave of elections across Europe. So it's going to embolden a different opposition. It's going to create upheavals politically. So that's just the reality. But the main thing is, you look at European leaders, especially Donald Tusk and people like this, they're constantly tweeting out and pushing out messaging about the victim and the aggressor, the victim and the aggressor. So I don't think you can come to any kind of real negotiations until you can accept the reality of how this conflict started to begin with. And it was a failure of international institutions like the UN Security Council and its members, who voted unanimously, for instance, for Resolution 2202 in 2015. They failed on the Normandy format. They failed on Minsk 1 and 2. And that's a European problem. It wasn't a Russian problem. It was a European and a Ukrainian problem, and that's on record. That's admitted by all of the stakeholders, from Poroshenko to Zelensky to Francois Hollande to Angela Merkel, etc. So until you come and have an honest conversation about how you got here, instead of trying to frame it in this Manichaean good versus evil, aggressor, victim, like Poland and other European, Ursula von der Leyen, they're all pushing this, Kali Kallas, everybody. They're pushing this because they want to keep the frame. And that frame is so important because that frame justifies all of the missteps and this entire debacle that is the Ukraine project.
But Patrick, you're absolutely right, because if you reframe it, then you're going to have to examine how you got to where we are now. And they refuse to do that. Matthew, they refuse to take responsibility for a situation that they created. And all of us knew it at the time. We were pointing it out in real time. You know what you're doing. You're creating a security architecture without Russia and against Russia. That's going to end badly. And it did. And it did. Matthew.
And this is where, and I can see the, what's the right way to put it? The temptation is to always focus on that beginning part where the missteps were and the miscalculations and the oversteps by one side. But it's also what I think is the back end of the problem can be a really significant obstacle in Trump's peace plan, because I'm almost worried that the content of his peace plan is not as important as the simple fact that I think Trump thinks it's all right. He accepts the fact that there's a place in this world for Russia to exist with relevance and power and influence. He sees that as a normal, acceptable thing. And that's the real back end of this problem, is most of the people on the West right now who are talking about negotiations or a peace plan, they're not saying it out loud, but behind closed doors, what they're saying is, we'll accept the peace plan that as long as it ends up with Russia being irrelevant, then we'll accept the peace plan. And amazingly, Russia isn't really for this kind of plan.
you're absolutely right. Let me go to Jim in Virginia. You know, we heard this phrase over the last few news cycles, coalition of the willing. Well, that's really quite remarkable, because there isn't even unity within Europe. So, you know, you have Stalmer acting like he's Churchill, miniature form, has no cards to play, has no money to spend. But of course, you know, he has to create a coalition of the willing. And you get the other people, non-entities like Macron, that buy into this rhetoric. They don't buy into a reality. They're buying into a rhetoric. They're buying into a narrative. And one narrative begets another bad narrative. Jim.
Well, I think that's true. We even see these rifts within Europe. I mean, Meloni has made it clear that Italy is not part of that coalition of the willing. Even the Poles have indicated that they're not crazy enough to be sending troops into Ukraine as part of the coalition of the willing. The Germans at this point are not willing to go along with it. So I think we have these divides even within Europe. But I think we have to be careful about overstating what the break is between Washington and Europe on this. I mean, there's one common denominator. The Americans have been demanding for years, Europeans, you must spend more, spend more, spend more. And now the Europeans are finally saying, oh, we're going to spend more. Now, maybe a hollow promise, maybe they don't have the capabilities. But in terms of what Washington is saying, you guys need to commit to spend more so we can partially disengage and go worry about the Chinese or something else, you know, do this reverse Kissinger thing. I don't think even Washington wants a complete break with Europe or a complete collapse of NATO, because that still is the American hand on Europe and keeping Europe under American control. I don't think Washington's willing to relinquish that even under Trump.
Yeah, I mean, Patrick, NATO has turned into the organizing center of European politics under America's thumb here. But Patrick, I've always thought that, you know, is it three-dimensional chess here? Get the Europeans to pay 5%, and then they're going to realize, wow, that's a lot of money. Cut our social welfare. Somebody with some courage. There's no courage in Europe now, with the exception of Slovakia and Hungary. Someone's going to say, you know, maybe we should negotiate with the Russians directly and save our own part of this world here. That's going to happen eventually. We all know it's going to happen eventually, but because they're all cut from the same DNA, no one has the courage to speak up and say the obvious. We need peace in our neighborhood, and Russia's in that neighborhood. You don't have to like each other, but you should all want to have peace. Patrick.
Yeah, so in that sense, the United States, is Trump especially, is caught in a little bit of a bind, because one of the biggest beneficiaries of this conflict has been, you know, the U.S. LNG fracking natural gas industry. So, you know, allowing Europe to trade directly with Russia again. I mean, relations between Europe and Russia weren't that bad before all of this kicked off. I mean, they were energy partners. They were trading partners. They had diplomatic relations. It was the U.S. that imposed Russiagate. It was the U.S. that imposed this new wave of anti-Russian hate, reigniting the Red Scare. And then when Trump comes in, he wants to sort of put a damper on it. But Europe's already away on the races. So they kind of created a monster by reawakening some of these political elements in places like Germany and Poland and other parts of Europe, and really stoking at the U.S. So it's hard for the U.S. just to back off. Like I said before, this transcends mere party politics or a change of administrations. It's almost like they've created a monster. They've reawakened a dormant beast, if you will, in a jingoistic beast in Europe that's created all sorts of problems. So I don't know. This is a very difficult, you know, Gordian knot to get out of for the U.S. and Europe.
Yeah, because Matthew, isn't it really convenient that there's aggregation of power in Brussels? Von der Leyen talking like she's like the first viceroy of Europe. I mean, not democratically elected or anything. It's very convenient to have an emergency like Russia, 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 isn't it? Because they can't solve any other problem in the EU, Matthew.
And there's a point to this that I think often gets missed to many analysts and specialists in the West, which is that there's almost, to me, there's this assumption of stupidity on the Russian side, that the Russians are not subtle and nuanced enough as thinkers to see these blatant contradictions and hypocrisies, and to say, for example, this classic example of, well, you don't have nothing to worry about with NATO, whether it expands eastward or not. NATO is a defense organization. and the Russians simply, but defense against whom?
Yeah.
Who are you meant? Well, oh, well, that's you. But don't worry about that part. Don't worry about that part. We're just going to expand eastward in defense against you, but you don't have to worry about us. And the Russians just will sort of throw up their hands and be like, you must obviously think we're stupid to hear that and just accept it at face value. And so there's a certain level of almost, I sort of have as an entreaty to people here, is that we need to start just being a little more serious about the other side as a partner in the negotiations.
Well, Matthew,
we've been just dismissing them.
I agree with you completely. And I think when everything is all said and done, it's going to be the Russians are going to have to teach the Westerners something about statecraft, negotiations, and diplomacy, because obviously all are missing in the Western world right now. Gentlemen, absolutely fascinating discussion. Glad to have you all back. But that's all the time we have. I want to thank my guests in Washington, Virginia, and in Plymouth. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, cross that rules.